Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to update one of the stories and one of the main focal points of this broadcast over the years, namely America's political assassinations of the 1960s and 1970s. We're going to begin by contrasting a couple of articles dealing with the recent verdict in a civil suit that was brought against Lloyd Jowers by the family of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. That civil suit was ultimately successful. They found Jowers culpable in the wrongful death of Martin Luther King, Jr., and the jury found that there had indeed been a conspiracy behind the killing of Martin Luther King, Jr. Anyone who is honest and has done their homework, who has studied the King assassination, knows that, but it is very refreshing to find that finding in an American law court, albeit many years too late. However, I want to emphasize the contrast between two articles, both from major newspapers, one a foreign newspaper and one a domestic newspaper. We're going to begin by taking a look at some reportage that comes from the Financial Times of London. Obviously, that is a foreign paper. It comes from the United Kingdom. I want to stress that the Financial Times of London is a very conservative newspaper. This is not some radical rag of some kind. Nonetheless, though, I think it demonstrates and is exemplary to a considerable extent of the much more cosmopolitan and open-minded attitude of the foreign press as opposed to the domestic press. And we're going to contrast this with an article about the same subject coming from America's paper of record, the New York Times. First, however, the Financial Times of London from Friday, December 10th, of 1999. This is an article by Betty Liu, L-I-U, in Atlanta. It's headlined, New King Verdict Revives Old Memories. It's from the Financial Times, again, of 12/10/99, and it reads in part as follows. The memories have not faded for those involved in the civil rights movement in the South or for their leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. When remembering those moments of protest on the streets of Atlanta or elsewhere, they sometimes forget and talk in the present as if those days only happened yesterday. But one chapter has finally closed. A jury this week confirmed what many blacks in the U.S. have always thought, that Dr. King was assassinated in a conspiracy involving more than one individual. After just 3 hours of deliberation, the Memphis jurors, six black and six white, found Lloyd Jowers, former owner of a diner, involved in that conspiracy. Mr. Jowers, now 73, had told a television reporter in 1993 he was paid to hire a hitman. James Earl Ray, the escaped convict who pleaded guilty to killing Dr. King and later died in prison, had always insisted he was set up by someone named Raoul. The verdict was hailed by Dr. King's widow and four children as a, quote, triumph over tragedy, unquote, a vindication for their father and husband who was gunned down on April 4, 1968 at a Memphis hotel. The family received a token $100 award in damages, which they will donate to charity. For black Americans, and particularly those involved in the civil rights protests, the verdict deepens the gravity of Dr. King's death. That it was caused not by one crazed man, but by a group of individuals whose organization reflected the wishes of higher authorities. It is far easier to ignore the actions of one man, they say, than those of many. Quote, we have always felt in the civil rights movement that there was a conspiracy to assassinate Dr. King at the very highest levels of government, unquote, says Lonnie King, a former chairman of the Morehouse student movement in Atlanta. Again quoting, it's pretty well documented that the FBI at the time had a serious dislike for Dr. King, as well as for everybody else in the civil rights movement. It would not be unreasonable for us to think that senior officials in the government could have had some knowledge or some involvement in it, unquote. There is little proof of that. That, by the way, is the in-copy editorialization of Ms. Liu in Atlanta. In fact, there's a massive amount of proof of that. I'll give some program references that listeners can basically reference in order to gain some of the relevant documentation. Beginning again, there is little proof of that, but the verdict does revive views that other assassinated leaders, President John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert, and black leader Malcolm X, were also conspiracy victims. Quote, it's always been my contention that there was a conspiracy involving two deaths, Martin Luther King, Jr. and John F. Kennedy, says Marvin Arrington, a lawyer and former Atlanta City Council chairman. Again quoting, that the jury said it was a conspiracy is a tremendous admission, unquote. Well, in fact, there's very conclusive evidence that there were conspiracies behind the deaths of both Kennedys and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and beyond that all of those deaths were connected. Some of the program references for the Martin Luther King assassination, all of these available from Spitfire. First of all, Radio Free America program number 8, the For the Record series about Orders to Kill, and some updates about America's political assassinations, including the assassination of Martin Luther King. And again, all of those are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. And you can see a list and description of those programs on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And again, RFA 8, the Orders to Kill series, and numerous other programs have information about the Martin Luther King assassination. There are many programs about the John F. Kennedy assassination and the assassination of Robert Kennedy and also Malcolm X. Now, again, note the relatively objective tone of that particular article from the Financial Times of London of 12/10/99. Ms. Liu did do her bit of in-text editorialization. She may have done that perfectly innocently. She may not be familiar with the circumstances surrounding this country's political assassinations, but do note that the tone of the article was relatively objective. Now, contrast that with the tone of the following article from America's newspaper of record, the New York Times. The following is from the New York Times of that very same day, Friday, December 10th, of 1999. So note two major papers from the same day, 12/10/99, but note the different tones. This is an article by Kevin Sack, and it's S-A-C-K, and Emily Yellen, Y-E-L-L-I-N, Dateline Atlanta, December 9th. It's headlined, Dr. King's Slaying Finally Draws a Jury Verdict, but to Little Effect. I'm not going to read the entire article, it's quite long, but I will read enough to give you an idea of the very biased tone. When 12 jurors returned their verdict in a wrongful death trial in Memphis on Wednesday afternoon, they became the first jury to hold someone responsible for playing a role in the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968. But with key players long dead, with confessions recanted and altered, and with a vast conspiracy alleged but not proved, Wednesday's verdict in the civil trial of Lloyd Jower seems unlikely ultimately to untangle the knot of fact and theory surrounding one of the century's most traumatic events. The jury in Memphis declared Mr. Jowers liable in Dr. King's death for having purportedly hired a now-deceased Memphis police officer as part of a vast conspiracy to kill Dr. King. It also found that unnamed others, including government agencies, had been involved. The finding came after a four-week trial that was notable for the passivity of the defense, the prevalence of second-hand and third-hand witness accounts, and the propensity of the judge and jurors to apparently nod off during testimony. At one point, James E. Swearingen of Shelby County Circuit Court allowed unsworn testimony from a 1993 mock television trial of James Earl Ray to be introduced as evidence. And skipping down, no hit piece, which is basically what this is, dealing with America's political assassinations would be complete without some editorialization by none other than Gerald Posner, who should be getting some sort of award for fiction, but unfortunately he has gone down in the public's mind as a writer of nonfiction. Skipping down, the conclusion of the article reads, Gerald Posner, an author who concluded in a 1998 book that Mr. Ray was Dr. King's assassin, predicted that the Memphis trial, quote, will be a footnote at best to the history of the slaying. Again, quoting, the defense in this trial was so lethargic, it raises questions of its sincerity, unquote, he said. That from Gerald Posner. Note that the New York Times basically concurred with that and talked about the passivity of the defense. In light of the way in which James Earl Ray came to be, quote, convicted, unquote, of the assassination of Martin Luther King, I think the editorialization there by both the New York Times and Gerald Posner is not only misplaced but more than a little ironic under the circumstances. We're going to go into if you want to hear about a passive defense, we're going to go into James Earl Ray's defense, which was passive past the point of intelligent belief. And first, though, I thought it might be worth hearing from members of the jury who heard this particular case. The Los Angeles Times of the previous day, you heard the LA Times and they heard the New York Times and Financial Times of 12/10/99. The LA Times of the previous day, December 9th of 1999, had the following story by Eric Slater, Dateline Chicago, headlined King was victim of a conspiracy, civil jury finds. And skipping down in this story, we find Juror David Morphy, M-O-R-P-H-Y, said he believed the assassination was too complex to be carried out by one person. Quote, "We all thought it was kind of a cut-and-dried case, with the evidence that Pepper brought forth that there were a lot of people involved. Everyone from the CIA, military involvement in it, Jowers was involved in it, we felt," unquote, Morphy told reporters. And again, note the response of the jury, and note the way the Financial Times of London, again, a very conservative newspaper, note how they reported this particular story, and note how the New York Times handled that story on the very same day. As I mentioned, it is extremely ironic that both Herr Posner and the New York Times would have alluded to the defense for Mr. Jowers as being very passive. If you want to hear about a passive defense, just stay tuned to this program. We're going to talk about how James Earl Ray came to be, quote, convicted, unquote, of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Basically, he never stood trial. What happened was he was induced to plead guilty, and then after a few days he changed his mind and then spent the rest of his life trying to get a fair trial. We're going to turn now to a book that was authored by James Earl Ray's defense attorney, Dr. William F. Pepper. That book is called Orders to Kill. It was published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff, and copyright 1995, ISBN number 0-7867-0253-2. Now, we're going to talk about the, quote, defense, unquote, of James Earl Ray. And as I've said a couple of times, if you want to hear about a passive defense, well, just stay tuned. First of all, we should note that James Earl Ray was accused of murdering America's number one civil rights leader. Just a quick accounting of who his defense counsel were, what his various defense counsels were, will give you some idea of the kind of, quote, defense, unquote, he had. One of his defense attorneys, the first defense attorney, was a guy named Arthur Haynes Sr. Arthur Haynes Sr. had been an agent with the FBI, but he quit the FBI because he considered it too liberal. He considered the American Civil Rights Movement to be a communist conspiracy. He then went to work for the Central Intelligence Agency as a contract agent training pilots for the Bay of Pigs. He was the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, when that city's Sheriff John Bull Connor unleashed police dogs and fire hoses on civil rights demonstrators. He then represented Earl Chambliss, a Ku Klux Klansman who was convicted on a 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. The 16th Street Baptist Church was a major gathering place for the civil rights movement in Birmingham, Alabama. It was bombed in the spring of 1963 with the loss of the lives of four young black women. And ultimately, that crime, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, came to be linked in a talk by a member of the National States Rights Party named Joseph Adams Miltier, with not only the assassination of Martin Luther King, but also the assassination of President Kennedy. On November 10th, 1963, an undercover Miami police informant taped Joseph Adams Miltier describing plans to kill President Kennedy by shooting him from a high-rise office building with a rifle armed with a telescopic sight. That's what happened 12 days later. Described similar plans to kill Martin Luther King in similar fashion and linked that with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. Miltier was a member of the National States Rights Party. That was a fascist political party, one of whose members was Jerry Ray, James Earl Ray's brother. Jerry Ray was a bodyguard for Jesse Stoner, J.B. Stoner, the head and founder of the National States Rights Party, who was another of James Earl Ray's attorneys. Still another of James Earl Ray's attorneys was a Hunt family attorney named Percy Forman. That's the very, very reactionary Hunt family of Texas. And Percy Forman stated that he felt that James Earl Ray had to be sacrificed in order to save the white race. Interestingly, Percy Forman had earlier represented Jack Ruby, and there are evidentiary tributaries linking Raoul and James Earl Ray and Jack Ruby, as we've talked about in updates on the assassination of Martin Luther King and other political assassinations. That is not much of a defense under the circumstances, and we're going to talk now about the, quote, defense, unquote, of James Earl Ray. Turning now to Orders to Kill by William Pepper, we're going to begin by taking a look at a guy named William Bradford Huey, who was the author of a book, a prospective book, called He Slew the Dreamer. And it was William Bradford Huey that got Arthur Haynes Sr. to represent James Earl Ray. Bear in mind that Haynes quit the FBI because he considered it too liberal. He thought the American Civil Rights Movement was a communist conspiracy. Worked for CIA on Bay of Pigs, became mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, when John Bull Connor was savaging civil rights demonstrators, then represented Earl Chambliss, convicted of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing that linked by Miltier to the assassinations of both Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy. Of William Bradford Huey and his role recruiting Arthur Haynes Sr. for the, quote, defense, unquote, of James Earl Ray, we read in Orders to Kill, "To most effectively prepare James's appeal, I had to understand the entire history of his representation, including the circumstances surrounding the guilty plea. I began at the beginning. Arthur Haynes Sr. had told me that he believed James sought him out because he had tried a similar case, the defense of Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, the defense of Alabama residents charged with the killing of a Detroit woman, Mrs. Viola Liuzzo. Mrs. Liuzzo, L-I-U-Z-Z-O, had been gunned down from a side window of an overtaking car on a dark road outside of Selma during the time of the historic Selma to Montgomery march. She was driving black marchers, as was I, out of Montgomery on that night. Haynes said that it was not unusual for him to be approached in such matters, for as mayor of Birmingham, he had proved to be a conservative on racial issues." Something of an understatement under the circumstances. Continuing, "Recall, however, that James's other choice was F. Lee Bailey, a Boston lawyer strongly identified with liberal politics. Haynes and his son, Art Jr., were contacted by author William Bradford Huey of Huntsville, Alabama, who wanted exclusive rights to write James's story. Huey had told Haynes that he could present the accused in a favorable light, and that the sale of the writing would be the means of raising money for the defense." Note that the profits that Ray was promised from the book were going to raise money for his defense. "In early 1968, Haynes made a trip to London, taking with him documents furnished by Huey. One was a very broad power of attorney, bestowing on Haynes the authority to act for James. In another document, James referred to Haynes any monies that he would receive as a result of a subsequent agreement with, in another document, James transferred to Haynes any monies that he would receive as a result of a subsequent agreement with Huey. These two documents were signed on July 5, 1968. On July 8, 1968, Haynes and Huey executed an agreement giving Huey exclusive rights to produce literary material dealing with the case. After several days, James decided to sign the agreement because he thought there was no other chance to raise money for his defense. Huey agreed to pay Haynes and James each 30% of the gross receipts from the literary works. James's money was to go directly to Haynes for his defense. In September 1968, at James's request, the July 8th agreement was amended whereby Haynes would receive a flat fee of $20,000 plus expenses. James asked for the change because he came to understand that Haynes was employed to handle the case only at the trial level, and he wanted to have available financial reserves for an appeal if necessary." We should note, and by the way, again note that William Bradford Huey was the fellow who basically got Arthur Haynes Sr., hardly somebody who could be viewed as objective on matters of race and civil rights, to, quote, represent, unquote, James Earl Ray and to provide his, quote, defense, unquote. William Bradford Huey figures in the story again, still later when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed, and James Earl Ray was once again trying to have his case heard by the public. Once again, William Bradford Huey showed up and once again made an offer to Ray that was very lucrative, and that if Ray would agree to plead guilty, then he'd get a whole bunch of money from William Bradford Huey, who would have the rights to publish James's story. Basically a reprise about 10 years later of what Huey had done with Ray and Arthur Haynes Sr. in 1968. Turning once again to Orders to Kill by William Pepper, we read, "Of all the indications of government involvement I encountered during my first investigatory period, none was more bizarre than the actions of William Bradford Huey. In 1978, Jerry Ray had told me that in 1976, as the House Select Committee on Assassinations was being formed, James Earl Ray's Nashville attorney Jack Kershaw was invited to attend a meeting in Nashville with author William Bradford Huey and two other persons. Huey asked him to take an offer to his client, a payment of $220,000, a pardon from the governor of Tennessee, a waiver of the outstanding detainer or escape warrant on him from the Missouri Department of Corrections, and a new identity in exchange for his unequivocal admission of guilt in the murder of Dr. King. Kershaw delivered the offer to his client, who rejected it out of hand. Bear in mind that a few days after James Earl Ray pleaded guilty to get money, he reversed himself and has been attempting to get a trial ever since, maintaining his innocence, which he did to his dying day. And note here that as the House Select Committee was gathering steam, William Bradford Huey basically is reprising his role, offering James Earl Ray money in exchange for a guilty plea, and in this case some pardons as well. Continuing, Kershaw delivered the offer to his client, who rejected it out of hand. A short time later, when Mark Lane had replaced Kershaw, Huey repeated the offer to Jerry Ray in the course of two telephone conversations which Jerry tape recorded. Ray's response was the same. Not long afterward, I obtained copies of the transcript of the tape. In the October 29, 1977, 12:15 a.m. conversation, the following exchange took place. Jerry Ray, quote, "So when this deal came up with James and Kershaw said you'd pay so much money if he'd, you know, plead guilty and confess," William Bradford Huey, quote, "Yeah, that's right, but let me tell you one thing clearly. I'm not talking about just a statement. I'm talking about something that James has never done in his life before. I'm talking about a story that says how and why, and he explains," unquote. 9.5 hours later, a second conversation took place. Huey, quote, "You're talking about $200,000 here, Jerry. The only thing that will be of any value for both a book and film, and put this right in your mind, why and how I killed Dr. King. I, by James Earl Ray, with the help of William Bradford Huey," unquote. Still later, William Pepper came to the same conclusion that most assassination researchers have come to concerning William Bradford Huey's role, or certainly that many have. Turning once again to Orders to Kill and skipping ahead, James's former attorney Jack Kershaw confirmed Jerry Ray's story about the offer made to him by William Bradford Huey in a meeting in Nashville. An offer was $220,000 as well as pardons from Missouri and Tennessee in exchange for James's admissions that he was the killer. Jack told me that he took the offer to James, who dismissed it out of hand. Later, as we have seen, Huey came back again with the offer but would go through Jerry. Kershaw believed that the two other men present at the meeting might well have been federal agents. He had no doubt that Huey was acting as an intermediary for the federal government, since he reasoned that only the government could arrange the pardons and the protection. I recall that Huey had previously developed a close working relationship with the FBI. So again, note that William Bradford Huey plays a very interesting role in the, quote, defense, unquote, of James Earl Ray, and it's ironic that the New York Times and the ubiquitous Gerald Posner referred to the passivity of the defense in the civil case. If you want to see a passive defense, what James Earl Ray got is your basic garden variety passive defense. William Bradford Huey's name crops up in connection with this country's political assassinations in another very interesting context. We're going to turn next to a book called Were We Controlled, subtitled The Assassination of President Kennedy. This book was authored by someone who wrote under the pen name of Lincoln Lawrence. It's actually the pen name for a guy named Art Ford. And this was published by University Books, copyright 1967. And the ISBN number for this particular book is 67-15098. And William Bradford Huey's name crops up in connection with a very interesting article published in 1961, which foreshadowed to a certain extent some of the circumstances surrounding President Kennedy's murder a couple of years later. Turning now to Were We Controlled, we read, we, meaning the authors, were told that a magazine published in August of 1961 had printed an open letter to JFK which bore the heading, "Attention, President Kennedy. Read the story, Murder in Texas," unquote. The author of the open letter was a prominent American writer, William Bradford Huey. It was a factual account of some dark doings of an alleged political assassin residing in Mexico. There were, in this tightly written account, some unfortunate and tasteless references to a certain figure now prominent in Washington, which preclude my quoting the piece in detail. And that basically, the when it says now in now prominent in Washington, that's 1967. And skipping down about this letter from William Bradford Huey, it was a plea to Kennedy to extradite the purported assassin from Mexico by using the power of the White House. This is very interesting as well, because the alleged assassin of President Kennedy, who of course was Lee Harvey Oswald, allegedly had some of his contacts with the communists who, according to some disinformation theories, helped to recruit Oswald in Mexico. And many of the most important evidentiary tributaries for some of the aspects of the JFK assassination investigation run through Mexico. Turning now to the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, November 22nd of 1999, one of these many evidentiary tributaries is a bogus phone call to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City by someone identifying himself as Lee Harvey Oswald, but who in fact was somebody else. The following is an AP story, Dateline Washington headline, "Papers suggest Oswald tape survived." It reads in part as follows. Hours after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, FBI agents purportedly listened to a tape of a phone call that a man identifying himself as Lee Oswald had placed to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. They made a startling discovery. The voice on the tape was not Oswald's, government records say. This controversial tape has been a question mark in the assassination investigation since Kennedy was killed. The assassination occurred 36 years ago today, and only now have new details about the tape come to light. The CIA said years ago that the tape on which it recorded the call, tapes on which it recorded the call were erased. Documents released in recent years said otherwise. The latest and newest of declassified documents offer more evidence that the tape survived. The discovery that the voice on the tape was someone other than Oswald was a, quote, disquieting discovery because the man who impersonated Oswald was still at large, unquote, said John Newman, an ex-military intelligence analyst, author, and professor at the University of Maryland. Oswald was in Mexico City in September and October of 1963. I would note that in that open letter in August of 1961, William Bradford Huey was pointing to Mexico as the locus for the purported assassin who was going to kill President Kennedy. Continuing. During his 1 week stay, about Oswald in Mexico City, during his 1 week stay, he contacted the Soviet embassy and the Cuban consulate, inquiring about visas needed to go to the Soviet Union via Cuba. It was also known that while he was in Mexico City, Oswald had contact with Valery Kostikov, a man that one CIA memo described as a, quote, case officer in an operation which is evidently sponsored by the KGB's 13th Department responsible for sabotage and assassination, unquote. It was the caller who is thought to have impersonated Oswald who links him to this Soviet spy unit. Newly declassified documents, some released in the past 6 months, say that after the president was shot, a Navy plane carrying a top-secret package from Mexico City to Dallas had landed there about 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time the day after the murder. And note again, William Bradford Huey creating basically the false scenario of Oswald the KGB assassin or Oswald the assassin a couple of years before President Kennedy was assassinated. We're going to continue with this discussion on the other side of the tape. That concludes this program. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.